see it. The court is ready to hear argument from relator and N. Ray McDonald.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeff Levenger will present argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, ma'am. Please, the court. The main issue in this case, as I see it, is whether a law firm must be disqualified when its client allows it to review corporate documents that the client either received or wrote during the time that the client was an officer of the company that later sued him. The answer I submit is no, and certainly, and more importantly from the perspective of mandamus, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in so holding and in refusing to disqualify the law firm. Now, there's been a lot of discussion in the briefs and in the Court of Appeals opinion about the application of the attorney-client privilege and the non-disclosure agreement to the documents. But I think the ethical issue in this case is the broader issue concerning disqualification, and it's that issue that I will turn to first. On the disqualification issue, we do not believe that the ABA ethics opinion that was involved in the Metter case applies here. This case simply does not involve unauthorized turning over documents to the law firm. We do agree, though, that the Metter case, at the very least, provides some guidance in answering the issues in this case. Now, Metter essentially focuses on three issues distilled down: the circumstances regarding the firm's acquisition of the documents and the client's acquisition of the documents, what was done after getting them, and I think most importantly, the significance of the documents, actually the prejudice standard. Here, I think each of these factors is more favorable to the firm than in the Metter case, where the lawyer still was not disqualified. Looking at the circumstances under which the documents were received, there was considerable dispute in this case, and remains considerable dispute, over how and when Mr. McDonald got the documents to his home office.
Mr. Levenger, before you go any further on the disqualification issue, the second aspect of the Court of Appeals decision was to mandamus the trial court to order the return of the documents. Are you not challenging that anymore?
I am challenging that, Your Honor. I thought I would turn to that last, but I'll be happy to turn
no,
to that.
I just wanted to clarify in terms of that. You're still taking the position that the Court of Appeals erred in mandamus in the trial court in that way?
Yes, the Court of Appeals abused its discretion in requiring Mr. McDonald to give the documents back. I'll turn to that at the end because I think some of the disqualification issues kind of inform that issue. With respect to how Mr. McDonald got the documents, there is considerable dispute over that, but I think the trial court resolved that dispute in his favor and obviously had the right to do so because there was sufficient evidence supporting the legitimacy of his receipt of those documents. To the extent the Court of Appeals found otherwise, and I do believe it found otherwise, several places in its opinion on pages 2 and 6, it engaged in impermissible fact-finding in violation of the Mendoza case and the Brady case. The court had no basis to say that Mr. McDonald improperly obtained those documents. I think the more important issue in this case, though, is what the law firm either knew or did not know. The firm knew that Mr. McDonald had written or received those documents as part of his duties as president of MIC. On the other hand, there's no proof that the firm knew that there was any wrongdoing by Mr. McDonald in connection with bringing those documents to his home office. The firm knew some of those documents were privileged. On the other hand, I think this is very important, there's no proof that the firm knew that the documents were privileged as against Mr. McDonald, who either wrote them or received them as a client representative within the meaning of Rule of Evidence 503. Indeed, until the Court of Appeals opinion, that was never the law in Texas, that privilege could be asserted like that against an author or recipient of the documents. The firm knew that the documents might be relevant to MIC's affirmative claim for damages against Mr. McDonald, as well as its claim for injunctive relief against Mr. McDonald. And the firm knew it had an ethical duty to be fully informed about all aspects of the case brought against its client. So based on this state of mind, which I think is critical, the firm should not be disqualified for doing what it was obligated and what it believed it was obligated to do, that is, to review the documents provided to it by its client in order to become fully informed about what the case was about so that it could effectively defend him within the bounds of zealous advocacy.
While
wouldn't that apply to the Metter case?
The Metter case was different, Your Honor, because in the Metter case, the documents were purloined. They were taken by a secretary to a president without permission. They were copied by the secretary without permission.
All right. So your statement you made assumes something about McDonald and whether or not how he got these documents and whether or not he had any privilege to have them. I mean, aren't you kind of on stage two?
Well, yeah, the first part of why I think this case is more benign than Metter is the manner in which the documents were obtained. The second part is the state of mind of the law firm.
Let's go to question one.
Okay, the circumstance under which McDonald obtained the documents.
Well, yes, and what right he had to them, because that seems to be an issue where different courts in different jurisdictions have reached different results, and we might be able to make some useful statement of the law there.
I think this court can make a useful statement of the law. First of all, I'd point out that as to half the documents, the Court of Appeals indicated that they weren't even privileged. So I've not seen them, but I'm just going by what the Court of Appeals said. And as to those, they ought to be turned back over to Mr. McDonald. As to the apparently privileged documents, the courts, as you indicated, are split on whether the attorney-client privilege may be asserted against a former corporate officer who clearly wrote or received those documents in the course of his duties.
Do you agree that the privilege is the corporation's, though?
It is the
corporation's privilege.
It is, and the issue is not one of waiver or who owns it, but can it be asserted against somebody who had written the documents or received the documents in the course of his duties. And I think a sensible approach is the one established by the Braniff case, which basically says that if an employee wrote or received the documents in the course of his duties, he should be able to see them in a later suit, subject, of course, to an appropriate protective order, which we have in this case.
Why doesn't the offensive use doctrine already serve that purpose?
Doesn't apply in this case, Your Honor, because as I understand the offensive use waiver doctrine, the issues have to be dispositive of the case. The materials for which you're claiming the waiver would have to be dispositive, I think.
And you're not claiming they're dispositive?
No. They don't even relate to this case.
So if we were to decide against you, you're not going to go down and try to get them based on offensive use?
I don't think we can claim offensive use. I think there are other bases for claiming the documents. I think they're relevant to his defense. I think they're relevant to the injunction claim made against him. And I think the privilege, and this is really where I'm heading on this issue, while the corporation may own it, it's not a privilege that it can assert against somebody in his situation who saw the documents, prepared the documents, and is now being sued by the company. And that's essentially what Braniff says.
Well, what's your view about the CA's footnote? It basically says, well, if you go into regular discovery and you ask them to produce them and you get them, then they're properly obtained as opposed to court's view that, well, getting them through the officer who takes them out of the possession of the corporate entity, that's really not, even though he knows what they say, he even wrote some of them, the privilege belongs to the corporation. So that's a wrongful way to get them. You have to give them back, but that doesn't mean you can't get them again later through a subpoena, et cetera.
Yeah, that may be true. We can get them later. To me, that goes to why the documents aren't significant in a prejudice sense, that is the matter factor on prejudice to the movement.
So are we really looking at the fact the real issue here is the disqualification as opposed to a big fight over these documents if you can get them later anyway?
I see the disqualification as the broader issue, the ethical issue. This court could assume, I suppose,
but
the purpose of
argument. I recall that the lawyers refused to give them back.
Well, the lawyers gave back the originals, and I think importantly, they agreed to mark the copies as confidential and to keep them confidential under the agreed protective order of the parties. Essentially, the only additional thing they want is to have the documents turned back over. I think that exalts form over substance and, more importantly, impairs the lawyer's ability to properly and effectively and zealously
represent. Well, what are you giving up if you say, yes, you can have the originals, but we're going to keep a complete set of copies.
That's what we did.
But have you really returned them then?
We've returned all the originals.
No, no. The whole ball of wax is...
Under the Court of Appeals, we had to because the Court of Appeals ordered us to do so. That's exactly right. The trial court did not.
I'm just speculating, why isn't it just easy enough to say, all right, here's the whole thing, even the copies we made. Now, we'll give you a subpoena and let's take a deposition and we'll get them properly.
Well, that assumes that's the only proper way to get them. I think another proper way to get them is when your client has them at his home office. The other side asks for copies of all documents that he has in his possession. He turns them over to his lawyer for review. They look at them, and they produce them. I don't think there's anything improper about that in the sense that there wasn't.
Well, so then that's the form over substance, aren't you?
That's the way I see it.
But if we were to find that the privilege could not be, or the privilege could be asserted in this instance, mm-hmm. then is there another avenue to get the documents? You said offensive use wouldn't apply.
Well,
so
we've got a request for production out there that requests all documents seen or reviewed or prepared, I think is the way it reads, by Mr. McDonald.
But doesn't that get us right back into the question? They'll assert the privilege.
They'll assert the privilege, and down the road we'll have to litigate it, I suppose. Now, that's why I answered Justice Hankinson saying that I am pressing that issue now because I think we should have it adjudicated. But I don't think it really decides or resolves the disqualification issue, which I view as being separate.
Well, are we going to have to decide whether, we will have to decide whether the privilege applies, correct?
I think so, because the Court of Appeals ordered us to turn the documents back over.
Right.
We're challenging that as being wrong.
So it is something we have to decide,
whether it
bears upon disqualification or not.
I think so.
And where I'm confused is if we were to find that the privilege may be asserted in this context, that the privilege belongs to the corporation and there's no exception, is there another avenue to get the documents?
Yes, and what I'm trying to do is craft a narrow exception based on the Brandon case. And what I'm saying is they may own the privilege. The privilege isn't waived, but they cannot assert it directly against somebody in the position of Mr. McDonald to prevent him from even seeing the documents and discussing them with his attorney, subject to the entry of an appropriate protective order, particularly when the company is suing. That's just the narrow exception
what
I'm trying
theory?
To craft.
I mean, is that an offensive use theory, or what theory
no,
is it that you're asserting that you want us to accept? I mean, whenever someone has seen them or reviewed them, then the privilege is waived? I'm trying to put it in legal terms.
I struggle a little bit, as you do, because the cases are not real clear about this. They're all over the board. The most sensible one I can see is the Brandt case, which said corporation may own the privilege, but as to individuals, in that case, I think they were actually suing, whereas I think in our case we have a stronger case because he's being sued. But they were saying, with respect to those individuals who saw the documents during the time they were with the company, who wrote them or who reviewed them legitimately, I'm going to order, the court said, we're going to order the company which owns that privilege to show the documents to the individual.
My question again is, legally, is that under a waiver argument that because they've seen them while they work there or received them that somehow the privilege was waived as to them? I mean, under what legal theory do we put that factual scenario to say that he's entitled to
it? I think the theory is that, although the Brown Court didn't articulate it, I think the theory is that somebody in the position of a Mr. McDonald would be a client representative within the meaning of Rule of Evidence 503A2, I think it is. That is, somebody who was part of the privilege at the time these documents were prepared or reviewed.
Well, the sort of joint representation.
Well, I hate to call it that.
I can see why you do.
That's not really theoretically correct either. I think it's more in terms of he was part of the privilege. He was a client representative within the meaning of 503A2 at the time the documents were graded. The mere fact that they've now split the sheets and one is suing the other doesn't mean that he can't at least see the documents and look at them and talk to them about his attorney.
Is there any other nexus that needs to be established? I mean, I keep getting back to the offensive use doctrine, but it seems like you just want a it's just not fair exception. I don't quite know how we would craft that.
Well, The Braniff case, and there are several others to talk about in terms of this, they put it in terms of it's simply a matter of fundamental fairness.
Would it always have to arise in the context of litigation between the former employee and the company, or does this Braniff rule apply in other contexts?
The Braniff rule specifically applied in the context of an employee suing the company. I would say this is an easier case where the company is suing the employee. To say that the employee can't even look at the documents that are directly relevant to the company's claims against him, that is that he was doing a bad job.
I know, but following up, I have the same little bit of confusion that Justice O'Neill's talking about, and that is, what if the employee's involved in litigation with someone else? Under that Braniff rule, could they go to the company and subpoena the documents and say, I've seen them before, company says they're privileged, and say, no, but I looked at them before, so I can have them and I can use them and I need them in my litigation against this third party?
I can see that the company would have two responses there. One, it would say it's not a matter of fundamental fairness because we, the company, haven't sued you or put this in issue. And secondly, I think the company could say, if we're going to turn these over to you, they need to be subject to a very strong protective order that would prevent you from using them or disclosing them for any purpose other than your lawsuit. And we've got that type of protective order in this case.
Under those circumstances, could the company say, in response to the subpoena, attorney-client privilege, they're ours, it's our privilege, too bad for you? Or would your Braniff rule, should the Braniff rule apply in those circumstances too?
I don't think I'd extend the Braniff rule that far. I think I would limit the Braniff rule to cases where, you can limit it as much as our case. The company has sued the employee claiming he didn't do his duties properly.
So this rule has aspects of the offensive use rule, just doesn't go as far as requiring the documents to be outcome determinative.
I think that's right.
So we'd actually be looking at the offensive use exception and actually liberalizing it a little bit.
I'm not sure liberalizing is the right word, but it is kind of a strain of the offensive use waiver doctrine without that dispositive requirement. I think it's probably more in terms of, I just continue to come back to fundamental fairness. If you're suing somebody, you ought to give them access to the documents he wrote so they can test whether or not the company is right in saying you didn't do a good job.
And what if he sued them?
Well, that's Braniff, and it makes sense there too, but to me it makes a little bit less sense actually, because there it's the employee taking the company on, and it would strike me that in that instance the fundamental fairness doesn't cut quite as strongly in his favor. But that was Braniff, and some other cases for that matter.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Shane Koshman will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Shane Koshman. I represent the Real Party and Interest Marketing Investors Corporation in this matter. Now, as I'm going to get to the Braniff opinion, immediately after I make a couple of preliminary points, and that is that this court needs to send a message to Texas corporations doing business in the state and the corporations that are interested in doing business in the state of Texas that it's going to protect their property rights and that it's going to protect their privilege the same way it did in National Tank v. Brotherton when this court said, we don't want to judicially legislate and change Rule 503, therefore we're not going to take the subject matter test. We leave it to the control group test, literally supporting the concept of the separateness of a company from its employees.
I don't understand that your opposing counsel disagreed with that concept. I think you conceded that the privilege was the corporation's, but that there should be a very narrow exception where the corporation is suing the employee and the employee has already received or reviewed the memos. For example, assume that the employee could go to court and testify about what he read or what he saw. If he can testify about the contents of the documents orally, why not allow him to have the documents?
There are a few reasons, and I might as well go into Braniff. The court should adopt the Braniff principles. For a few reasons. First of all, by the way, Braniff the corporation was the plaintiff. Second of all, the court in Braniff specifically rejected the whole Gottlieb line of cases, which essentially derived from the Kirby line of cases, a Delaware state court case, said it's unreasonable, it doesn't make sense. It started off with that premise. It specifically said, look at the U.S. Supreme Court in Weintraub. The corporation is the only privilege, is the only holder of the privilege. This court should follow that analysis. This court should follow the analysis in Braniff, where that court went and spent extensive time and multiple different ways said, you have to protect this privilege. Don't even let them make a copy of the documents. The attorney can't even take a copy of the document back with them, and the attorney can't even discuss these documents with other people they represent. In this case, the trial court provided virtually no protection in the face of opposing counsel saying, without contravention, it's, quote, great, end quote, that we have these privileged documents, and I'm going to show them to all the third-party witnesses, who, by the way, very well could be the very parties that were involved in some of the privileged communications, the subject of them, and I think that the agreed protective order allows me to do it. No protection from that. Not to mention, in Braniff, the court held, A, you're doing a proper request for these documents, and then, outside of that procedural protection, it spent a great deal of time saying, and you can't just do a fishing expedition where you say, I saw a whole bunch of documents, and therefore I'm entitled to them. It said you'd have to identify the documents, describe their contents, multiple procedural protections to do what this court said it needed to do in Republic Insurance, which is figure out why there is no way you cannot protect the privilege under these circumstances.
We don't need to identify them here, do you? No, there's not any dispute about which they are.
That's right, Your Honor. They were bait stamp numbered. I have no idea why they couldn't be returned, but...
So I don't see the significance of identifying.
No, but once that's the whole point to affirmative use waiver and why there's such a significant prejudice here. And unlike Braniff, in this case, you already reviewed the documents. You reviewed them multiple times.
Well, why I'm very confused about your argument about Braniff then and how it applies in this case. Are you agreeing with Mr. Levenger then that under these circumstances, this defendant to this lawsuit should be able to see and use these documents subject to a protective order in this litigation?
Absolutely not, because the key to the Braniff decision, there was not a single part of that decision that said, and therefore we're going to allow them to look at these documents because it's fair. The Braniff decision, after citing Weintraub, distinguishing, completely rejecting Gottlieb, said, there is this principle called the Garner Principle, a 1972 case out of the Fifth District. It applies when you have shareholder derivative suits.
Tell us what should happen to the documents in this case, the documents that are at issue that gave rise to this mandamus proceeding. What should happen to the documents as this litigation proceeds?
This is exactly what happens. The documents are returned. They are not disclosed to third parties. I don't think that the discovery requests that are presently on the file should be there because I think they're tainted, but a set of discovery requests are served that says, give us blank documents, comply with the discovery rules. My client asserts whatever objections it has, including attorney-client privilege if it's so applicable, and then someone comes in and says, wait, under Rule 193, I want a privilege log. We provide a privilege log, and then they say, we think that these following documents are not privileged for the following reasons. Are you going to give them to us? I say maybe, maybe not. For the ones that I say maybe not, we go to the court, and I believe, unlike Braniff, that adopted a, quote, good cause waiver standard under Garner, they would have to prove an affirmative use waiver under Republic Insurance. If they can meet the affirmative use waiver argument,
entitled to them. And even under, even then, the court would have to provide a much more, because affirmative use waiver, the theory that this court said is that it's basically a sanction type of situation, the court would still have to form some type of protection to protect against the disclosure against third parties, even under those circumstances.
Let me ask you a question, and I'm not at all clear. Let's assume that everybody agrees that the corporation has the privilege, but a corporation only works through agents. So clearly agents have the information. And as best I can tell, this president had permission to have access to this information when he was president of the corporation. There was nothing, the corporation didn't say that he didn't have the authority to have access to this information. He argues that he wrote some of it and that he got reports on some of it as a part of his official duties. I mean, you're not arguing that that's not correct.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so now here's an agent that has the information, both documentary and knowledge. You can't, it seems to me, it's an impossibility for the corporation to say, divulge that knowledge from your mind. So all we're talking about is documents that contain the information that the president has in his head. But he had permission to have those documents. Is your argument that because the corporation has the privilege that there's some authority that requires this agent to to erase this knowledge, or is your argument that you're afraid that this agent is going to somehow waive the privilege of the corporation?
It's not the first, and it's a little bit of the second, and let me explain. The key point here is unauthorized possession and who owns the documents.
Well, he had authorized possession.
Not after he was terminated. He was not authorized to have those documents after he was terminated. He surely wasn't authorized to have those documents.
Does a corporate privilege, again, this goes back to he's got the knowledge. He has documents that are reflective of that knowledge. Does the corporate privilege have with it an element that when an agent leaves the employment, that the agent must erase that knowledge?
No.
Does it have an element that there's a cause of action that the corporation has to go to the agent's office, and they say their home office, to retrieve that information? So does a privilege incorporate a cause of action to go after a former employee to retrieve information that they otherwise were privileged to have?
You mean documentary evidence, documents?
Yeah, or whatever their computer, whatever may have this information that they once had that they had permission to have. Does the privilege create a cause of action for a corporation to go out once the employee leaves the business to retrieve that information?
Oh, no, Your Honor. The privileges, Texas Rule of Evidence 503 and 511, are solely the floor. They're not the ceiling. There's been case law. This is the oldest privilege that exists under common law, the attorney-client privilege. It's been protected in multiple different ways. Common law is protected.
I'm not disagreeing with it. My question is, does that privilege encompass some sort of cause of action on the part of a corporation to sue an employee to retrieve the information that the employee had permission to have, but since they no longer work for the corporation, does the privilege give them some? Could I go to law court and I say, this president used to work for me and had access, had information of privileges. I am now suing that president for a injunction to require that president to give that information back. That's my question. Does the privilege entail that kind of
The privilege, just as in patent would, provides it provides that certain information and documents are confidential. Nothing more than confidential. And when someone is terminated from a company, the same way they have to return their keys or they have to return their corporation, their corporate car, or the same way they have to return their corporate laptop, they have to return documents that don't belong to them. They surely have to return those documents when the corporation finds out that they have them and says, return those documents. Not only under the clear terms of an employment contract, assume the employment contract doesn't even exist. That's a flaw. Under the common law, when the employer says, hey, wait, that's ours. That laptop that you had in your closet, that's ours. And those documents, the policy manual, all those other documents, that's ours. And surely we don't know why you have these attorney-client privilege documents, but those are ours too. Give them back. Yes, you have to give them back. The law in the state of Texas should not be that you can use what isn't yours without following the law and proper procedures. That shouldn't be the law in the state of Texas.
What about disqualification?
Disqualification, I'm glad is brought up. And again, and I'll go directly to disqualification with the ending of Judge Charrington. That was a Garner principle. Here we have Republic Insurance and we have affirmative use waiver. Disqualification, it's interesting that opposing counsel mentions the Meter decision, because frankly, again, the Meter decision is important in this case. The whole motion for protection was filed under comedy law and it involved documents. But Meter is an excellent example of why there should be disqualification in this case for
but
a few reasons.
It set forth some requirements of harm in
yep.
order to have disqualification, even if everything else the attorney did was bad. And I think what Judge Acton's asking is, how have those requirements been met
exactly.
on this record? And that's really all we're, I mean, disqualification or not is all we're here to decide.
And when you are mentioning harm, you're mentioning harm because there's two standards. There were six standards. And there are six factors, non-exclusive factors. And I think four of them are pretty much met the same way they were in Meter in terms of you didn't follow the proper procedures once you had the documents. Not much more than what after 900 hours of work, this court came up with Rule 193.3D.
Have you been harmed?
Now, the concept of prejudice and harm, it's very important to recognize that in this case, unlike the Meter case, there was documents that were privileged, one of which dealt with 30 pages of litigation material. If I may show the court, we have one exhibit that was in the tropical level, 30 pages, where unlike Meter, which was ready to go to trial, this came in at the most initial stages of the litigation.
But if Mr. McDonald had all this information separate in his head, separate and apart from what the document said, and he could sit down with his lawyers and talk about it, then what evidence of harm or prejudice was before the trial judge at the point in time that he made his decision to not disqualify the law firm?
There was a great deal of evidence, and interestingly, if the trial judge actually held that the documents don't even have to be returned and you go out and show them to third parties, clearly from an abuse of discretion standard, he never even reached
well,
that.
Just tell us why the trial court abused his discretion in not disqualifying the law firm with respect to this harm or prejudice element.
Three reasons. Documents are different than what is in someone's head. And two observations before I give the three reasons. One is, it's very difficult. He had the evidence of the opposing party themselves saying that these documents are critical to our case.
Just go directly to the evidence of harm and prejudice that was before the trial judge when he made his decision. What is it?
The evidence is as follows. First and foremost, again, these are documents that the opposing
opposing side says are critical to the case. Secondly, in this case, unlike in Meter, this all came at a time when the very foundations of this case were being woven. It was woven into the fabric of the case.
Are they critical to the case?
Are these documents critical to the case? No.
Well, okay. Then doesn't that get you out of the outcome, I mean, the offensive use exception?
Well, yes,
you said that
not,
they could get them through offensive use.
That's correct. We don't think that they will be able to get them through affirmative use waiver at this juncture, but the point is, were the proper procedures followed, which I think are no, and then with regard to the prejudice issue, the point is, in this case, unlike in Meter, these documents have now been woven into the very fabric of the case.
Well, why can't you just unweave it? I mean, been a counterclaim, so it could be withdrawn, it could be ordered struck.
The reason is this, because it has been re-reviewed so many times over, Your Honor. How does my client know what these attorneys have allegedly because they were in these documents?
But if it's not critical to the case, why isn't that a sine qua non of disqualification? Are our disqualification rules just to rove around and find bad people and then keep them from having having any clients?
Absolutely.
Or are they to make sure that the case is tried fairly? And if they're not, if they are not critical documents, which is the one thing you all both seem to agree on, how come that doesn't end the inquiry?
It doesn't end the inquiry for the same reasons it doesn't end the inquiry when there is a double or rebuttable presumption under strict Texas law when there's a switching of sides or any others. A, there's an appearance of impropriety. B, I don't think that's the only reason, because that's kind of a touchy-feely type of reason. It doesn't look good, although I do think it's very important to take a look at the legal profession at this juncture. I think the main reason is because assuming the counterclaim is wiped out and they cannot use the counterclaim anymore at this juncture, even from trying to deal with an affirmative use waiver scenario, you have the very counsel, God knows what's in the files already, who have reviewed not only by one counsel, not only by two counsel, but by their lead counsel also, not only once, but multiple times with multiple copies, these privileged documents. Talk about being able to identify the documents when you get to an affirmative use waiver scenario. They're surely going to be able to do it at this time. They're surely going to be able to use these documents at any point in time throughout, because they never returned them, not only from before October 10th when they filed their own motion for protective order, but they have reviewed them so many times over.
But Mr. Koshman, if they're not critical to the case, how has your client been harmed or prejudiced in a way that would require disqualification of the opposing law firm? If they're not critical to the case.
Because.
Where's the harm to your client?
Because these documents, assuming they can be used, are going to ultimately, again, be put in and injected into the case because they're so familiar with these documents. And it's important to note, Your Honor,
according to your view of the case, as I understand, we don't know at this point in time that they might not be able to get the documents and be able to use them in the future. You say that issue has not been resolved, but there's a procedure to be followed. So how do we know at this point in time that there is any prejudice or harm to your client?
Because these parties have reviewed, re-reviewed, and said they're going to show these documents to third parties.
But if the information in the documents is inconsequential to the case, doesn't make any difference, then where is the harm to your client?
The harm to my client is the same harm that any client would have when they say, you mean the other side has my privileged documents and they concern every litigation that I have, but they could look at that and they could still be in this case? It is the common sense type of harm of how could they do that? It's the same common sense that went behind Rule 193.3D. That rule says return the documents, no questions asked.
Is there anything else that you point to in the trial court record that is evidence of harm or prejudice?
Oh, yes. The fact that, and I see I'm out of time, so I'll make this very brief. The fact that some of these documents are literally attorney-client privilege from internal and external attorneys regarding the sale of the company, which is one of the very issues that they're raising in their counterclaim. And although it's not awkward determinative on the legal standard because it wasn't hard to do legal analysis, it's very relevant to some of the claims in this lawsuit.
Anything else?
So if they return the documents, they shouldn't be disqualified?
No, they did not. The very law firm that established the common law bright line standard and who argued to affirm that bright line standard before this very court should be disqualified because the conduct that it engaged in flew in the face of every one of the four elements of 94382 of the ADA formal opinion, and there is virtually no evidence whatsoever in this record that there will be any disqualification, any harm caused by the disqualification at all, which is one of the standards, one of the factors under Meter. And in fact, this court spent a full column of its opinion talking about this.
Well, here's the point I'm trying to get to, and that is merely because they have seen what may otherwise be privileged documents doesn't mean that they should be disqualified.
No, if they return the documents.
Right. Okay.
If they follow the standards, if they saw the documents and picked up the phone and said, hey, we have some documents. We even think that he was entitled to these documents, and we think there's affirmative use waiver, but wait a second. We know that they say you're privileged. What do you want to do with them? Well, let's put them in a seal. Or at least if they say they don't want to return them, say, okay, let's take it up with the judge.
No, I got you. I just misunderstood what you said earlier.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Briefly address harm because I don't think there is any. And that is a factor the Court of Appeals essentially ignored in its opinion. And it's something that the trial court was entitled to and probably did find the absence of. In Meador, the court focused on actual prejudice and said that and looked at whether the information in privileged documents will significantly prejudice the movement's claims and defenses in this suit. My firm lost the Meador case. We did not get that firm disqualified. And I submit that the documents in that case were much more pernicious than the documents here. The documents there that were secretly copied and covertly removed from the company related directly to the settlement strategy, the litigation strategy of the company in the Meador case. I think it reflected the president's notes taken during a mediation and the president's notes and some conversations he had with counsel. And still, this court found no prejudice to the movement. Here, the documents are far more benign than Meador. They do not relate to, they do not disclose MIC's litigation strategy or settlement strategy in this case. They relate to other cases.
Why do you want them?
Why do we want them?
Why do you need them?
Well, it's funny how they kind of got ahead of themselves. I don't know that they are all that critical. I've never seen them. But what they're trying to do is to use the fact that we've seen them because our client showed them to us to disqualify us.
Well, let me get away from the disqualification issue. In terms of having to return them back to the corporation, Texas has expressed a pretty strong preference for protecting the attorney-client privilege. And there's a narrow exception by the offensive use doctrine. If you can't show that they're outcome determinative or that you need them, they're necessary to your defense, why not require you to return them?
Well, I have trouble divorcing the question from the fact that they're then using that, the fact that we saw them to offensively disqualify us.
Well,
but putting that to one side.
I'm just talking about what we do with the documents.
With the documents, right.
Sounds to me like you don't really have any real objection to returning them because they're not critical to the litigation. They're not outcome determinative.
Critical is probably not the right word. I think they're relevant because what they're suggesting in this case is that Mr. McDonald didn't do his job properly, that he didn't properly assess the value of the company, that he didn't properly assess the severity of the lawsuits that the company was embroiled in. And I think these documents are important, although he's got the information in his head, but the documents are important to help him refute the notion that this was an extremely valuable company that he undervalued and negligently negotiated the sale of. I think the documents will help him analyze how severe the litigation actually was against the company. It's just historical information.
But doesn't the test itself, the offensive use doctrine, affirmative use doctrine, doesn't that sort of embody a policy choice by the courts that client privilege documents are going to be protected unless an outcome determinative showing can be made?
It does, and I don't argue, as I mentioned earlier, that it applies here, but I'm with Justice Hankinson in trying to, I guess, liberalize use or word that test to extend to a very narrow situation where the documents were created by or reviewed by the client representative within the meaning of 503A2, who now is being sued by the company, and in my view has a right under the principle of fundamental fairness
to see those documents in litigation. What would happen if employee left and kept these documents? I guess following up on Judge Enoch's question, does the company have, and there is no litigation, but the company learns that the employee has these privileged documents. Is there a mechanism by which the corporation can get those back?
If there's no litigation, I think the company could probably sue the person to get the documents back.
Well, what if they did that, sued them to get the documents back and then waited and then filed their lawsuit?
Against the employee?
Yeah.
Then the employee may be able to get re-access to the documents under a proper discovery request.
And to do that, it would have to show the offensive use exception, correct?
Well, it's the exception, not it's the grant exception that I'm creating for this case. It's not really offensive use. It's the exception where if you saw or created the documents while you were an employee legitimately, you should be able to get re-access to them when you're sued, if you can make a proper showing of relevance and so forth. That's the narrow ruling which I'm trying to articulate here for the board. And it's a strain, I think, of offensive use, and it probably comes more from Grant.
If we think that Mr. McDonald is not entitled to documents that were covered by the attorney-client privilege of the corporation, are there fact issues whether these are covered by that privilege or not?
I believe there are. I've not seen them, but the Court of Appeals...
So the trial court would have to take another step.
To analyze the issue of privilege, I think that's right.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes today's arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.